This evening's talk is about the parami of ethics, or sila, our sense of integrity as we live our lives. And we spoke a little bit about this on the very first evening that we were here. And so it's lovely to speak about it on our last evening together as well. And that really very much sums up the place of ethics within the path. It's both what enables us to begin, as we begin to live with more integrity, with more harmlessness, with more honesty, with more kindness. That provides the conditions for the mind to settle and gather, which in turn leads to deliberating wisdom. And then that, of course, expresses itself through compassion, through kindness. So ethics is really in many senses where we begin, and also the fruit of the path. The Buddha puts it like this: upon goodness of heart is built wise attention. Upon wise attention is built liberating wisdom. So this sense of integrity is really born of a kind and loving and open heart, and has the power really to transform a person's life. You think about perhaps situations in our own life when somebody has shown us some kindness, when somebody has behaved to us in a way that really lifts us. It can really just change our worlds in an instant. A sense of kindness, being touched by the kindness of another. There's a nice story which illustrates this. Leaving to attend her first meditation retreat after a tense and fraught week at work, a woman drove for many hours through a snowstorm, becoming increasingly anxious and stressed, only to plow a car into a snowdrift a few yards from the entrance to the center. Walking into the building, she saw a sign suggesting loving kindness and a milling crowd of people preoccupied with their own arrival arrangements, and she became even more distraught. Meeting one of the staff, she began to berate him for the weather, the road conditions, for almost every trauma she had experienced in her life. Asking for her keys, he offered to park her car and bring her bags to her room while she helped herself to dinner. After leaving the retreat, she wrote to thank him, saying that that one single act of kindness had touched her so deeply she would never forget it. This sense of living with ethics, living with integrity, is so powerful. Yeah, we never quite know. We never quite know how important it's going to be. So living with ethics, as I was speaking about the other day, is about a transformation of emotion and a transformation of motivation. So moving away from a sense of looking for what's comfortable, looking for what's easy, looking for what's in it for me. There's a change in motivation that looks outwards. Yeah, looks outwards. How can I act with kindness? How can I act with respect? How can I act with integrity? And the scope of ethics is really enormous. It's really our whole lives. Considers how can we heal our relationship to the planet? How can we heal our relationship to society? To the organizations we're part of? To our communities, to our family, and to ourselves? That's enormous number of lives really comes within, enormous number of areas of our lives where this sense of ethics is absolutely vital, vital. So thinking on that global level, that planetary level, looking at our patterns of consumption. And I think one of the wonderful gifts that this practice brings to this whole discussion about, environmental issues and ecology, is this sense of a joyful simplicity. One thing we can really begin to discover through practice, those moments when just the breath is enough, feeling the breath coming in, feeling the breath going out, and it's plenty. Feeling the foot on the floor, and it's enough. So there can be, through practice, this sort of transformation of our sense of what brings us pleasure, what we need in our lives. And we can begin to do with less, but not out of a sense of kind of having to because, you know, we shouldn't or it's bad or anything like that, but just really not needing quite so much. Yeah. Perhaps we could say the more that there's a sense of inner abundance and inner fullness, the less there's that sense of looking for things, looking for something extra or different. This practice really has a lot to offer in terms of healing our relationship with the environment. And so too on a social level, I mean, this is involves in, among other things, you know, perhaps engaging with the political world. How do we engage with the political world? I mentioned the other day that I met David Loy, this eminent Buddhist academic, and I plucked up some courage to ask him a question. I put up my hand and said, you know, can I ask you a personal question? And he looked at me and said, I'm not quite sure this is the place for that. But I said, you know, don't worry, it's, you know, appropriate enough. And really what it was about was how to balance this kind of inner, what we might see as an inner journey, this journey of finding peace in our own hearts, and this question of engaging skillfully with political realities and political situations. I mean, I don't know if any of you feel similarly, but, you know, I've sometimes had the sense of, you know, perhaps wanting to be more engaged, but seeing how so easily some activism can kind of slip into a them and us kind of situation, yeah? Where there's a sort of a kind of righteous indignation or a, you know, feeling of holding on to anger against some other. There's a separation that can so easily arise in those kind of situations. And I certainly don't think the answer to that is, you know, a complete kind of disengagement and moving away, but it really requires some skill. I mean, you know, there's countless, thankfully, countless examples of people who've managed to do that. I mean, you know, these people, of course, become icons. But you know, you think of Nelson Mandela in his prison cell, learning Afrikaans, learning the language of his captors. After apartheid, you know, setting up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Engaging in the political world and in a way that really still holds that perspective of wanting to heal division. Not simply replace one division with another. You know, today's oppressed becomes tomorrow's oppressor kind of situation, but something that really moves out of that whole kind of setup, really. Ethics, too, is about how we live within our organizations. I mean, that'll be different for different people here, but, you know, whatever organizations we have contact with, perhaps community organizations or work organizations or... I mean, organizational life is its own endless and interesting area of study, and the things that can happen, the subgroups and the subcultures and the what's happening under the surface and what's, you know, officially going on. And again, really, you know, bringing a wisdom to that that's reflective. Yeah, it's reflective. Not simply being caught up in the habitual patterns that might be around us, but looking to see what can build trust. Yeah, what can build trust. Working skillfully within our families, You know, I know for many of us this is the most challenging thing of all, perhaps. I certainly heard many people talk about this actually, that, you know, they can come on retreat and they feel very peaceful and very calm and very in touch with wisdom. And, you know, the one thing that really challenges that is going back to the family. And, you know, for many of us it can kind of trigger, you know, patterns, trigger old patterns. So again, as best we can, and you know, there's no kind of simple formula for this, unfortunately. It's just a matter of sensitivity, of curiosity, of investigation, of being willing to begin again, again and again and again, to come back. I read a book quite recently by a Thai teacher. I was talking about attitudes to parents, and it's really very, very striking, the kind of difference to something that I'd be likely to read in the West. And to be honest with you, I feel slightly cautious about sharing this with you, but I shall voice my caution and then share it with you anyway. I mean, my caution is that I really don't know your family situation. You know, so I'm not making assumptions. And I'm well aware that some people's situations are, you know, really profoundly difficult. I mean, I think most families have some level of difficulty. But, you know, so with that word of caution, I shall share with you what he says. But he talks about the kind of gratitude that we could have to parents, which is just, wow, it's just like, you know, he talks about everything they did for us. You know, again, hopefully, you know, feeding us, clothing us, keeping us warm, going out to work perhaps to look after us, providing a roof, you know, doing their best to teach us certain things. And from his perspective, there's a kind of, it just this enormous gratitude that can be there. Yeah. And I just offer that as a kind of, as a gentle sense of possibility, the kind of thing that can shift those family dynamics, really. You know, just thinking, yeah, there's all this stuff that was messy or difficult or didn't go well, but just seeing, was there that, those things to be grateful for, those connections we can feel. Well, as I say, being gentle with that, and being kind to ourselves within that too. And in my little journey through the scope of ethics that started with on a planetary level, moved through societal level, through organizations to family, and then we come to our relationship with ourselves. You know, bringing harmlessness to ourselves, generosity to ourselves, honesty to ourselves, clarity. And we've been working with that so much this week. And it's so connected with these other areas, yeah? If there's that kind of kindness, inner harmony, that welcoming, non-judgmental, easeful attitude with ourselves, it really does just flow into our relationship with others. So they're really not so separate, that sense of being ethical, being kind, being good really to ourselves and being good to others are intimately connected. So when we're thinking about bringing this quality of ethics into our life, this quality of integrity, again, it's important to consider what we might think of as the shadow side, yeah? The shadow side. It's not really just a list of what we should do, how things must be, or some kind of excessively rule-based idea of how we should behave. I mean, that really doesn't help. You know, we all know what we should be, you know, that kind of thing. But how are we, really, you know? So as we've been talking about all week, making space is really the key to working with what we might call our demons or our shadows, yeah? Hatred never ceases through hatred, but through love alone does hatred cease, says the Buddha. And that applies here in our own hearts, yeah? When we feel anger or fear or mistrust or ill will arising, we welcome it. We befriend it, we make room for it. We allow it to arise, we allow it to pass through in its own time. Famously, the Buddha is often pictured sitting on a lotus flower. And lotus flowers don't grow in the clear water, they grow in the mud. Yeah, it's from the mud that those beautiful qualities arise. And I think we can also draw a lot of inspiration from the Buddha's own story. Yeah. The Buddha struggled with these things, you can read about it. I've been using this word shadow, and I've been using this word demons, and in the Buddhist tradition the word is Mara, if you're familiar with that word, which is the personification of those things which get in our way. And what does the Buddha do with Mara? The Buddha knows Mara. Yeah? So on the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, Mara sends all his armies, he sends all his daughters as well, I think they play their part. But he's got a whole kind of strategy, a whole series of strategies of attack, which he tries to force on the Buddha. And the Buddha just says, I know you, Mara. I know you. Yeah. So I don't think we really need to worry too much about this sense of, you know, do these patterns arise? Do they not arise? The thing is, can we know them when they arise? And when we know them, we become free. I just want to give you a little example in my own life about kind of working with ethics and this sense of knowing Mara. As I've mentioned a few times, you probably know, I work in a college, and sometimes, this is confession time now, okay? But sometimes I've got a little bit bad-tempered about what happens there. And I won't give you the proliferation of thoughts about it, but it basically boils down to this, that obviously doing this kind of teaching, I feel that, you know, education should be about the emotions, it should be about awakening a sense of curiosity, it should be about a love for learning, a love for life, and it should be about the whole person, yeah? Not just the kind of intellectual learning, but a learning that includes the heart. So you can imagine, this is probably somewhat of an idealistic view to take into state-funded education in England, but I'm learning. And, you know, and sometimes the college can seem, you know, we've got to get them through the exams and get the results and push them harder to sit more exams and, you know, you got 73% A to B last year, how are you going to get 75% this year and what's your plan? And I'm like, oh, you know, but what about all this peace and holistic education? And so this is something I kind of continue to work with. But at one stage, I think I was acting in a way that, you know, as I said, confession time, I wouldn't think is particularly wholesome. So I got into a couple of habits, really. One was sending emails about this, usually to the college principal. Yeah, which usually told him what I thought, but perhaps not in the kindest way. Yeah. And they weren't, you know, they weren't kind of horrifically offensive. I wouldn't want to give you the wrong idea, but it was just a little bit too blunt. and perhaps not anything he could really do anything with, you know. It wasn't what I would see, and this is what I aspire to in my speech. It certainly wasn't a gift. I don't think he would have got that email and thought, oh, wonderful. You know, somebody sort of suggesting something good for the college. It would have felt like an attack, yeah? And of course, if you attack somebody, then what you get is a defensive response. So, over time, I, you know, it started to dawn on me, maybe this isn't really a very wholesome thing to do. And so, I made quite a strong determination, and this is part of ethics. And sometimes, we just have to say no, inwardly. I've done this with several things in my life, actually, but it's almost like you take a kind of vow. You're setting an intention, you know, I will not send that kind of email. You know, really clear. When you do that, and then the impulse arises again, you know, they need to know, they need to be told, you know, I've got to get it across to them, you know. You can begin to say, I know you, Mara. I know you, Mara. So you're not so lost in your own reaction. And Mara is clever, yeah? Mara is clever. Mara doesn't say, I'm Mara, I'm inviting you to send an email out of ill will. Mara says, I'm righteous. I know what's right. I'm on a crusade. I'm going to put college right. I'm going to tell him. I know what's what. That's what Mara says. So it's subtle to know Mara. And maybe we begin to know Mara in one area of life, and in other areas he, you know, carries on unnoticed. So we develop awareness. So we understand him more fully. I mean, just to finish the story, I'm doing all right with it as well. You know, you can train yourself. You can train yourself. I haven't... can't remember the last time I did one of those. But probably a good couple of years coming on for. So, anyway, well done. Congratulate myself on my ethical training. But it is a training, this, yeah? It is a training. This moves me on to quite nicely to what is sometimes called the ethics of cultivation and the ethics of restraint. Yeah, the ethics of restraint is really what I've just been talking about. It's when there's an impulse arises that's perhaps not particularly wholesome, not particularly skillful, and we're able to be mindful and know that, and have the restraint not to act from it. Yeah, not to act from it. The ethics of cultivation is, in my mind, more about getting to a space where the motivations of kindness and compassion and honesty arise with more ease, really. So these qualities are more and more, you know, coming into our hearts and minds. There's less of that having to kind of say no to inner impulses, but the inner impulses are more and more wholesome. So we're cultivating really positive habits, the ethics of cultivation. I'm going to borrow a little bit of Western philosophy to explain this a little bit more. Hopefully this helps. But it's something from Aristotle, actually, if you're familiar with Aristotle's ethics. But he talks about a move from what is called incontinence to continence to temperance. Okay, so these are all slightly unfamiliar words, so I'll explore them a bit more. But that the sense of incontinence basically means not being in control, being uncontrolled. So sometimes we can feel like that. We might have a general intention to be kind or honest or whatever, but the impulses sometimes get the better of us. And impulse takes over, habit takes over. Yeah. So if we go back to me and the emails, you know, the place where I start in that story is what we might call a kind of incontinence. There's a kind of habits or impulses arise. They're perhaps not fully understood and they're simply acted out. Yeah. Or a situation, I mean, again, we could all think of different situations for us, but perhaps somebody who wanted to stop drinking or cut down on drinking alcohol. But then there was a time when, you know, somehow the impulse got the better of them. That would be that. But Aristotle describes how we can move on to what he calls a kind of continence or control. So this is where the impulse arises to do something. But there is this sense of being able to say no. To be able to cultivate a different habit. Not to simply act from that kind of reaction. Yeah. So we move from being kind of a bit out of control to having some kind of control. But the next point is the point I think is really interesting to reflect upon. And this is what he calls temperance. And temperance is a real inner harmony. A real inner harmony with our intentions, our deepest wishes, and our motivations start to really become in tune with each other. Yeah? And at that point, inner life is not so much of a struggle. So ethics becomes more of a kind of natural outflowing of compassion and kindness and honesty. And it's not so much a kind of, oh, I want to do that, but I shouldn't. You see what I mean? So it's a moving on from a kind of a state of inner disharmony to a state of inner harmony. Maybe what we call moving on from this ethics of restraint to this cultivating this natural sense of goodness. I don't know if you ever have the feeling that there's some things in life that are really pleasurable, a lot of fun, yeah, but I shouldn't do them because they're bad. You know, that kind of way of thinking about ethics is perhaps quite common, and perhaps in the system I've just been talking about corresponds to what we might be talking about, that kind of continence level, yeah? But I think it's possible really to have this vision of a harmony. Yeah. So it's not that there are things that really would be lovely and really would benefit us, but that we shouldn't do them because they're bad. But we begin to really feel what is truly beneficial, what truly benefits us, what truly benefits others. Yeah, beginning to come into a kind of harmony with that, really. Yeah, motivation and intention coming into tune. One of the questions I love discussing with my college students the most is this question, why should I be moral? Why bother to be moral at all? And on their course, you know, they have to look at kind of various responses to this. But the one that really rings true with me is when we begin to sense that acting with integrity, acting in a moral, ethical way, is also acting in our best interest. Yeah? Ending this division between what's in it for me and what's in it for you. That kind of mindset born of separation. They can begin to be really sensitive to it. If there's a lot of greed present, what does it feel like? We can feel the kind of unpleasantness of that mind state. What's it like to be angry? When we're really lost in anger or ill will or aversion, we are suffering. Now, the Buddha says it's like, you know, you're holding this hot coal and you're clenching it. Your hand is burning. Yeah. So when we begin to see that, we can drop it immediately. Yeah. So these states which are the roots of behavior which harm others are simultaneously harming us. Yeah, is it really linked? So the Buddha said, no one who truly loves themselves could even harm another, for they would be harming themselves. And Burmese teacher Upandita says, how can we expect to deepen in understanding if we do not live an ethical life? Living without integrity, we endlessly create the conditions for unpleasant mind states and feelings to arise. Yeah, so we're just seeing that, really knowing. And so too those positive qualities, as Caroline beautifully spoke about yesterday, the joy of generosity. You know, knowing that, taking pleasure in that. The wonderful connection that's born of honest communication. The discomfort there when dishonesty. The more we're sensitive to this, the more we're sensitive to this, that kind of sensitivity really flows into the way we speak and think and act in the world. So our ethical life includes living more and more with motivations of harmlessness, of non-violence. And most of us, I don't think, tend to commit extreme acts of violence or cruelty. But I think an area really to bring attention to there is what happens, you know, perhaps through carelessness or when kind of habit takes over or there's some kind of sort of something about personal advantage, you know, there's something in it for us. Again, really having that deep commitment to living with non-violence, living with non-harm. Bringing that to ourselves. Bringing that to ourselves. That's the I think really been a kind of underlying theme through this retreat has been this sense of letting go of the inner critic, the inner judge. One can even be called Christina Feldman at one stage calls it the inner terrorist, you know, and kind of undoing ourselves, blaming, judging, you know, kind of feeling guilty about things. Our ethical life includes generosity. This is really served by letting go of what we might call the philosophy of entitlement. Yeah? So there's something here that the Dharma really goes against the stream, if you might say, of current culture or contemporary culture. I mean, how many messages do we get that tell us to have it all? To live in luxury, to expect a life with no discomfort, to seek happiness by gratifying more and more desires. And my wife sometimes gets different kind of women's magazines, and
they were, you know, always really interesting to me to have a look through and kind of explore things and learn about all kinds of things. But I noticed one of these magazines that said something like, for the woman who wants more. So I said to her, you know, should we start a magazine called For the Woman Who Feels That She Has Enough Already? You know. So the woman who wants more is, you know, the kind of icon of what we want to be. More, better, quicker, faster. This kind of attitude is so often the message that we get. You know, how many advertisements tell us, you've got enough. You've got plenty already. Have you ever seen that? You know. So as we said before, our sense of ethical life includes being honest, building trust, that sense of intimacy with people. Yeah. As I explored in the talk on truthfulness, that connection between honesty and connection. You know, we often say in Dharma circles, don't we, this sense of looking to an inner happiness and a happiness that doesn't depend on conditions. But there are things in our outer life that certainly support our happiness, support our peace. You know, they may not be the direct cause. But I would say one of those is definitely our friendships. You know, we'll talk a little bit more tomorrow about the importance of friendships and community in spiritual life. Yeah. And what really helps us nurture friendship, a sense of openness, intimacy, trust, again is another of the many countless examples of how an ethical life really serves us. Yeah, if we're kind, honest, open, trusting, then that really infuses our relationships, our friendships. And that too, of course, enriches our lives greatly. Our ethical life includes our sexual lives, our lives in relationships. Moving away from relationships based on exploitation, disrespect or fear, towards generosity, care and respect. I don't know how you feel about this, and I need to make sure I don't generalize too much, but it sometimes seems to me that, you know, our culture kind of swings in extremes about sexual ethics almost, you know. And as I said, this is somewhat of a generalization, but you know, you might imagine that, you know, perhaps in the 1950s it was, you know, mum, dad, two kids, everybody was married. No sex before marriage. Really clear what the ethics are. I mean, I think historians will tell us that actually it wasn't so simple. But for my story, it makes it nice. Then in the 60s, all that goes out of the window and free love, and yeah, free expression, you know, let's be wonderfully non-attached by, you know, giving up monogamy, and it's a outdated institution, and be free and do what you want whenever you want. What is it? I can't remember the phrase. Turn up, tune in, drop out, something like it. I wasn't around in the 60s, so there you go. But I've heard about it. And you know, then in the 80s and you know, AIDS arises, and you get the kind of new right in America, and then it swings back the other way. No, traditional values, and no sex before marriage, and the 60s was really bad, and, you know, let's get really strict again, all that kind of thing. And then, so, you know, here we are now, and I don't know where we are culturally. I mean, so, you know, sometimes I think on a cultural level, you know, we may be confused because we're just heirs to all these different messages from, you know, perhaps very traditional, somewhat puritanical messages, you know, perhaps messages of the, you know, the other extreme where sort of far too much emphasis is put on, you know, sexuality and almost, you know, too much expected from that. So really finding a, you know, finding a middle path, I think. Finding a middle path. And see, is an area of life where, which is powerful. Yeah, a very powerful communication, sexuality. So if what's being communicated is disrespect, it's powerful and damaging. If what's being communicated is love and kindness, again, it's powerful and enriching. And I think in this area of life, again, there's a, you know, a kind of need to move beyond this sort of duality between being really Puritan on the one hand and a kind of false freedom of a kind of free-for-all on the other hand. You know, finding a kind of wisdom there. Something else that Upandita says, I mentioned him a little bit earlier, is that lust cracks the brain. Lust cracks the brain. And lust is a wonderfully old-fashioned word. And I remember talking to some colleagues about this, and I said, I was sort of talking the way I do, said about how painful lust is. And, you know, they thought I was being incredibly kind of old-fashioned and out of date, and that, you know, lust was actually quite good fun. But again, I mean, really bringing sensitivity to that. When we are really infatuated with another person, and I don't mean this in some kind of hyper-traditional, judgmental sense, but we are really quite confused when that infatuation has really got hold. Because, you know, we were talking about this sense during the week of my well-being depends on this. And how we can do that, and I was pretending to do it with the bell. It's very unlikely we do it with the bell. It's very possible we do it with another person, you know. This person absolutely is the source of everything good in my life. I mean, people can feel like that. Without this person, my life is nothing. And this actually can be really painful. Really painful. I mean, I may be making assumptions, but I suspect most, if not all of us, have known that mind state, yeah, of infatuation. And you sort of can go into a room when that person's not there, and the only thing you notice in the room is the absence of this person. You know, the absence of this person. When my brother got married, actually, the person conducting the ceremony said a rather beautiful thing. You know, my brother is, don't know how to put it really, he's a person of faith, we could say. And but they were describing, you know, because he and his wife certainly have a spiritual path, and that meant that they weren't putting too much weight on the marriage. And I thought it was a really wise thing that the person said, you know. It's not bearing too much weight. Because another person cannot be the source of all our peace and happiness and well-being and our ultimate security. So when we're not trying to pin that on a person, then, you know, we can be free to relate as human beings. So too our sense of ethics can embrace this clarity of mind. In particular, looking at our relationship perhaps to alcohol, to recreational drugs. And with alcohol in the Dharma tradition, you tend to get kind of two schools, really. These aren't official schools. But one school seems to say, you know, complete abstinence, don't touch it. It's much better to just, you know, don't drink a drop. It's much clearer. Yeah, much clearer. And the other school is more looking at the effect on the mind, you know. So the real, looking at the spirit behind the precept, which is about this sense of a clarity of mind and bringing awareness to all of our lives. And you know, some of us move between these schools and spend some time in one school and some time in another school and move backwards and forwards. And that sense of investigation is really important in our ethical lives. And I think one thing that really helps us in this area is being able to face what is difficult. And that's what we've all done this week. I mean, I think this is a real fruit of this week. I don't know really exactly what's happened for all of you, but I do have a trust that we've all touched places that are perhaps difficult, hard to bear, and we've somehow stuck with it. You know, one of the things about a retreat is that the normal props are not here. You know, often in our daily life, you know, we're not feeling so good, and then the TV comes on, or the fridge door's open, or, you know, on the phone to a friend, or sending someone a text, or on the internet. I mean, we've got hundreds of things these days to do. But here, you haven't. Yeah. So those difficult places, and how do we work with it? How do we make space? How do we befriend that? And the more we find that inner resource to do that, you know, again, that's undermining the tendency that might seek to cloud that by, you know, having a drink. It's really confidence-giving to do that. And so too, at times, perhaps the sense of inner joy and nourishment, as I was speaking about earlier, the sense of the simple pleasures, touching a richness in our inner lives. Again, that can enable us to just, you know, put those other things down. They're just not needed really in a... Life is full. Life is abundant. So there's a sense that our ethical life is a practice, it's an investigation, it's a training. Yeah, I mentioned earlier with my email story, just one aspect of the training, and we can pick different areas in our own lives. Where do we need to train? Where do we need attention? And, you know, work with particular intentions over weeks or months. And integrate this learning into our life. As I said, it's both the ground and fruit of practice. An ethical life helps us calm, which helps us see clearly, and that clear seeing expresses itself in more wholesome ways of thinking, speaking, and acting in the world. A sense of a life of integrity, a life of ethics, kindness, respect, harmlessness, and honesty. Really an essential, indispensable part of this path of awakening. So may we live more and more in ways which truly benefit ourselves, that truly benefit others, and truly benefit the world.
May we be well. May we be happy. May we be peaceful. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful.